This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
This is the evening edition. I'm Uma Paganampike Pagan, and you're listening to an ongoing series that's dedicated to the superhero. An in-depth look at how this uniquely American invention has grown over the last century to become a global cultural phenomenon. An attempt at better understanding this incredible modern mythology and how it's come to bear such an influence over our collective cultures. It's something I call When We Last Left Our Heroes.
And can we start right away?
Yes, we can. I'm good when you are.
Okay.
Fantastic.
I am ready.
Before I begin, could I just get you to introduce yourself and what you do so I can get my levels right?
Can I can give you levels, but I'd rather you introduce me. Isn't that the way it works with a guest? 47 years ago, our fathers brought forth unto this continent a new nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. We're now involved in a great civil war, testing whether that nation or any nation can. Are you good?
Perfect. That's great. Thank you very much. Episode 15, Neil Adams, Part 1. Neil Adams. For those of you who don't know comics, Neil Adams is an absolute legend. He would define the Bronze Age. He would leave his stylistic mark on the X-Men, Green Lantern, and Superman. He would take Batman, who had become a campy joke at the end of the 1960s, and bring back the brooding Dark Knight long before Frank Miller. Neil Adams, alongside Denny O'Neill, would create one of comicdom's greatest villains, Ra's al Ghul, who we've seen play a prominent role in both Christopher Nolan's Batman trilogy and TV's Arrow. The both of them were also the ones responsible for giving us that marvelous fight between Superman and Muhammad Ali. Along the way, he would co-found the design studio Continuity Associates, become a self-taught science buff, and a tireless crusader for creators' rights. He's received numerous awards and has been inducted into the Will Eisner Hall of Fame right alongside Jack Kirby and Stan Lee. But in the 1950s, Neil Adams had a hell of a time breaking into the industry, and not because he wasn't good, but rather because of Friedrich Wertham and his fight to end comics. So Neil, how did you get started in comics?
How did I get started in comics? It's a long story. I got started in comics in 1959, I believe, out of high school. The high school was an art high school, probably the only art high school on Earth, the School of Industrial Arts, it was called at the time. Now it's called the School of... what's it called now? I forget what it's called. Anyway, I guess it was a school that was left over after FDR's vocational high school program. Anyway, so we have in the United States, I don't know if you guys have them there, what are called vocational high schools, where people who are not going to go on to college can go to what is called a trade school, where you
right.
learn a trade so that when you leave high school, you're able to go out into the workforce and actually make a living. This was industrial arts, it was called. Industrial arts is a rather loosely defined term, but they did have quite a few classes, including fashion design and cartooning and stuff like that. They did not have a comic book class. In fact, in America, unbeknownst to you folks in the rest of the world, America had put comic books on trial just as they did communists in the 1950s, and attacked communists, and once they were through with communists and they discovered it was a silly cause put on by corrupt politicians, they were still enamored by the fact that these legislators could appear on television and attacking communists. Why not do something as salacious? So they decided, for whatever reason, after turning their dictionary to another C word, they decided to attack comic books.
It is my opinion, without any reasonable doubt and without any reservation, that comic books are an important contributing factor in many cases of juvenile delinquency.
And so these hearings appeared on television, which is the worst possible place for something like this to happen. And comic books were put on trial, and the defenders of the comic books in those days, which were like, you know, monster comics and zombies and monsters and things like that, were unable to defend themselves very well. And America turned against comic books. And this happened in 1953 when I was in Germany with my father, who was stationed in Germany as part of the occupying forces of Germany. Like I said, this is a long story, and you should be sorry you asked it, but there you go. So I'm in this vocational high school teaching something that clearly has no future. Because America had decided comic books were going to be going. In fact, any indication that I got from any teachers or from people out there in the world was that comic books were going to be gone within a year. There will be no more comic books in America next year. And, of course, I was a kid, and, you know, when people say things like that, it's like talking about the atom bomb, really. So I don't think it's going to go off in my backyard, so we'll see what happens. I wanted to do comic books. I wanted to do comic strips. I wanted to be an illustrator. And there was a pathway, and the pathway was to do comic books first and then go on to do a comic strip and then go on to do a illustration. This was the path. And that was the path I chose to follow, even though I was told by everybody that somebody had thrown minefields in the pathway and I would never get through and it would never happen. Comic books. There would not be comic books in a year. When I went out into the field after high school with my samples from school, which were, by the way, professional in nature, I went to DC Comics and discovered that everybody was telling me the truth, that DC Comics did not even want to look at my samples, did not want to consider me, I couldn't see anybody, and in fact, I should do something else with my life because comic books would be gone in a year.
Comic books would be gone in a year, and that was the world in 1959. After this, how Neal Adams finally broke into comics. When we last left our heroes, the evening edition, BFM 89.9. Hello, superfans. It's me, Uma. If you are listening to this on radio, this is where there usually be ads and music, but on the podcast, I fill you in on some stuff you should be reading, watching, and listening to if you're enjoying this series. It's all Neal Adams this week, so let's start with his work on Deadman. Neal Adams took over the art for Deadman after his first appearance in Strange Adventures 205. Adams helped mold the character and the rest of his origin, where assassinated acrobat Boston Brand finds himself stuck in a state between life and death as he searches to find out who killed him. These books featured some truly incredible paneling and storytelling, dynamic artwork that had an almost kinetic energy in pushing the story along. And now, back to the show. You're listening to the evening edition and when we last left our heroes. So my first encounter with your work, though I didn't know it was you at the time, was through the Ben Casey comic strips. And
yes, I didn't know it was me at the time either.
And don't ask me how they got into Kuala Lumpur. All I know is that my mom was a huge fan of the TV series, and that's probably how I got my hands on them. But what struck me as a kid, and especially on the Sunday panels, was that I'd never seen paneling like that before on any comic strip. And I hadn't, really. These Ben Casey comic strips were nothing short of remarkable, a soap opera tour de force. When Neal Adams was just 21 years old, he was awarded the Art Chores of the comic strip based on the popular TV show Ben Casey, starring Vince Edwards. He was at the time one of the youngest syndicated strip artists. Neal started his groundbreaking work on November 26, 1962, and the Sunday strip was added on September 20th, 1964. 4 years later, the strip ended as the TV show did, but you can see Neal's signature style in almost every panel. There is this one particular Sunday strip that stands out in my memory. It had this hidden face that cut across four panels. It was experimental, it was stylistic, it felt almost too good for a newspaper comic strip.
And that was the world that I came into. I was told by everybody they would be gone in a year. There were no comic book companies around. There was DC Comics. There was no Marvel Comics. It was called Timely Comics, and they were hidden in the backwater of New York, and nobody could find them except for people who had phone numbers. Dell Comic Books, who I believe was out of California. Western was out of California. Or if they were in New York, I didn't know where the hell they were. Then there was Harvey Comics, and you couldn't find them, and Archie Comics, which were, I believe, at the tip of Brooklyn somewhere. And so the only thing that was left for me was Jack Kirby and Joe Simon were doing what you call the Fly comic book and a couple of other comic books at Archie Comics. Archie Comics was taking a chance and doing realistic superheroes once again, even in the midst of this depression of comic books, knowing that comic books would be out of business in a year. So I went to Archie Comics, and I asked to see Jack Kirby and Joe Simon, who some people, even there and wherever you are, know who they are. They're pretty much legends in the comic book business. And so, unfortunately, they weren't there. I would bring my samples in, and I would come in next week, and they were not at the office. They were working at home. Finally, the Archie people, having pity for me, put me on the phone to Joe Simon, who said to me, "Neil, kid, listen, you know, I saw your samples up at Archie, and they were really good and very professional. In fact, if it were another time, I would hire you. But, in fact, I'm going to do you a big favor. And I know you're not going to realize that it's a favor now, but in the future, when you have a real job and you're doing real things with your artwork, you'll realize that I'm doing you a big favor. I'm not going to use you because, kid, you have to understand that there's not going to be comic books in about a year. Comic books are going out of business. They're on their way out of business. And if I were to, if I were to take you on, I would ruin this portion of your life. You need to go on and do something more useful and better for yourself. Do something else. And I apologize, but kid, you know, I'm turning you down. And I know you won't believe that this is a favor, but I am doing you a favor. Thank you, Mr. Simon. Click. I hung up the phone. I turned back to the Archie guys, who looked at me with sympathy, and I believe it was Victor Gorlick, who is still on staff at Archie Comics, who said to me, "Maybe you want to try to draw Archie Comics." And I said, "I will draw anything." So I began working on my Archie samples. And I did Archie samples, and I brought them in the following week, and then they criticized them, and they told me they weren't perfect. So I went home. I got a Dan DiCarlo Archie comic book drawn by Dan DiCarlo, who was the premier Archie artist, and I blew up his pages and I traced them. And then I handed them in, and they said, "Well, they're not perfect, but yeah, we'll use you." And that was my first work in comic books, Archie comics.
What's interesting, of course, you know, that story you just told me, it makes it seem like the barrier for entry in 2015 is so much easier.
Oh, yes. It is amazing. Look, at my friend, we are taking over the world. The only thing that's stopping us is the executives at the major comic book companies. But you know what's happening is that the artists and writers are going to the independent companies, and they're doing their own comic books with the independent companies because the market is so good and so broad and so international in scope. Remember, with the internet and email and all the rest of that, a business that only took, you know, Jewish kids from New York City to draw their comic books now is drawing from a marketplace that is the whole world. We have artists from South America. We have artists from Czechoslovakia. We have artists from China. We have artists from everywhere. And
Paul's latest work, Dr. Fate, his artist is Sunny Liu, who's my neighbor down south in Singapore.
Well, you're merely verifying what I'm telling you. The community, the business of comic books and comic book related material, believe me, the business of comic books is very small compared to the business of comic book related stuff, which is television shows and movies and computer games and all the rest of it, is so gigantic and so massive and so inspired by young creative people doing wonderful work, and it is so worldwide. You know, it's like saying, they only make good movies in America. No. Now America is making good movies for the world and drawing on the talents of the whole world, whether it's comic books or comic book related material or whatever. We've become, you know, peace in the world is going to be brought about by internationalization of our cultures through comic books. I hate to say it, folks, but that's the way it is.
So this must make your lifelong quest for creators' rights so much easier now.
Oh, it makes me giddy. It makes me giddy. You know, the thing is that it's one thing to be right in the face of the majority opinion. It's another thing to be not only right, but to be proven right day after day and to have it grow and grow and grow and to see it happening right in front of your eyes.
For decades, Neal Adams has battled for the rights of creators. In a time when the big two companies, DC and Marvel, retained penciled pages, he fought for artists' rights and the return of their artwork. He would work alongside other folks in secret to get back some of Jack Kirby's original art and return it to his family.
It's not like, you know, I'm some crusader who fought for something and then, oh, before it happened, he died and went to hell. It's happening right in front of me, and I'm watching it happen. I mean, all the things I've ever said, all the fights I've ever had, all the battles I've ever had with the corporations, all I do now is I sit back and say, why did you guys argue with me in the first place? You were wrong, I was right. That's the end of it. You're idiots. And now guess what? You're profiting by it so much, so much. No fight I ever had with these companies was ever motivated by my taking anything away from them, but in fact helping them build themselves into gigantic, incredibly rich industries. Why were they fighting with me to begin with? Because you know what? It was stupid. It's one thing to be wrong. It's another thing to deny your own future. They were denying their own future. I'm fighting with DC Comics to get them to become rich. Yes, you do have to bring your creators of Superman back in the fold. Yes, you do have to give your originals back. Yes, you should pay royalties to your artists so you can take their stuff and turn them into billion-dollar movies. All of these things are true, and you guys are just a bunch of knuckleheads who are standing in the way of progress. No, I'm watching all the result of these battles take place right in front of my eyes. And it's not that I'm right, it's that we're all profiting by it. Everybody's doing great.
I'm speaking to comic book legend Neal Adams. After this, I ask him what it was like getting Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster long overdue compensation and credit for Superman. When we last left our heroes, the evening edition, BFM 89.9. Me again. Another must-read is Batman number 251. Neal Adams, Denny O'Neil, and Dick Giordano teamed up for this famous issue that would redefine the Joker for a new generation of Batman readers, returning him to his violent roots. It is one of the most iconic Batman stories of all times, and Adams is just astonishing in this issue. And now, back to the show. This is the evening edition, and when we last left our heroes. In 1938, Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster sold Superman, rights, image and all, to the publishers of Action Comics for a paltry $130. It is a deal that Larry Tye, author of Superman, the high-flying history of America's most enduring hero, calls the original sin of the comics industry, and a swindle on the order of the Dutch West India Company's 1626 purchase of Manhattan from the natives for $24. It was $130 that created a multi-billion dollar industry. It was $130 that made a lot of people rich. A lot of people except Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster. The story goes that when Neal Adams was elected president of the Academy of Comic Book Arts, he learned what had happened to Siegel and Shuster, and it was shocking. Joe Shuster was sleeping on a cot in front of a taped-up window. They didn't have a proper pension or health coverage, and these were the guys who had basically created the entire comic book industry. In one early conversation, Shuster had told Adams about a new Superman Broadway show. He said how he would watch all these peoples going in to see a show based on his character, movie stars and politicians and other famous people, and he would tell Adams how he was so proud and flattered. And when Adams asked Joe Shuster what he thought about the show, he replied, "I couldn't afford to see it. I didn't have enough money." Now, Adams knew from a legal perspective, Siegel and Shuster didn't have much of a case for reclaiming Superman. They had knowingly signed away their rights, no matter how bad a decision that was. But something doesn't have to be legal to be right, and it doesn't have to be right to be legal. Siegel and Shuster needed a strong voice, someone from inside the industry who would also reach out beyond the comics world. And Adams, who was the most popular artist at DC and the cover artist for Superman, became that voice. Even though it meant going up against his own employer, Adams launched a series of media appearances, press conferences, and meetings to drum up support for the Superman creators. Instead of going to court, Adam decided to go to the court of public opinion. He fought and he won. DC finally agreed to provide Siegel and Shuster with financial assistance and medical benefits. They were also credited by name in every subsequent Superman comic. Siegel, who passed away in 1996, and Shuster, who died in 1992, were able to live their remaining years in dignity. Neil, you got to tell me about, I mean, you were credited with winning Siegel and Shuster long overdue compensation and credit. That must have been quite the moment.
Yeah, it was, but you know, it's like when you get into a fight, you know, you finish with the fight and you wipe the sweat off and you take a shower and you walk out into the morning sunshine. You say, okay, I won. Now you guys, you know, deal with it. And it, you know what? And you're dealing with it and you did fine and you're doing fine. Why did you argue with me in the first place? What is your problem? All I'm doing is saying, take the creators of Superman that you have ripped off and screwed in their lifetime and now given them some compensation that makes them live the rest of their lives in comfort. And this is, you think, is a bad thing? Hello? Knock, knock? Are you out of your mind?
I remember reading something you said a while ago, and I love it, and you said something along the lines of corporations don't create characters?
No, corporations. DC Comics and Marvel Comics, and what I said was, DC Comics and Marvel Comics and no comic book company ever creates anything. They never create anything. They are the engine that moves it forward. They are the engine that sees that it gets on the press. They are the engine of distribution and all the rest of this. But they never create one single thing. You know, it's like, you know, something's owned by DC. No, it's not owned by DC Comics or Marvel Comics. It's owned by the creators. It's just the law and lawyers and judges that make it the other way. But the truth of the matter is that they not only don't create anything, they don't have the capacity to create anything. Could a lawyer create Batman? It's ridiculous. All they can do is grab it, you know, and take advantage and find a way to market. And they have marketing people, they have distribution people, they have licensing people, and they have ways of moving it forward that the independent artist doesn't have. But the independent artist creates. He initiates and creates. That's what he does. And the corporation doesn't do anything.
It seems like a golden age to be reading comics, but from what you're telling me, it sounds like a golden age of creating comics as well.
Oh boy, no kidding. It really is. This is the perfect time. All the things I've ever said. I mean, when I started my battles with the companies, and I said to people, you can go out and print your own comic books and put your own name on them. And you know what? There's a distribution system that's rising up where you can even get distribution. You got things like Cerebus the Aardvark, which is one of the earlier things. You got Wendy Pini doing ElfQuest. Right at the beginning. Then later on, you have Sergio Aragonés doing Gru the Barbarian.
Yeah.
And me doing Ms. Mystic and Jack Kirby doing Captain Victory. And people doing things independently. Now we have a whole community of people who when they wake up in the morning, every artist and writer in the business, when they wake up in the morning, they say, well, will today be the day that I do my new project and take it over to Image or to Dark Horse and profit for it? Or do I do more pages for DC and Marvel and get paid well? nice choice to make, wouldn't you say?
And I guess those guys at Image seem to have struck upon a really good working model.
And they seem to have done it, exactly. But you need to make an ocean to put fish in it. What I did, What I did was I made the environment under which these things could happen by letting people know that it was okay to do it, which seems like a very simplistic and stupid thing. Oh, let them know it was okay to do it. But up to that point, they didn't even know. I could tell you this. I got a call from Jack Kirby. Okay, Jack Kirby had worked for Marvel and then worked for DC, and then he was going out to California to do storyboards, and he called me and said, "Neil, I got these kids, they're calling me, and they say they want me to do a comic book and that they'll pay me, but I'll be able to own it." He said, is that possible? I mean, that's totally insane. How will they be able to do that? I'm going to get ripped off. I said, "No, Jack, you're not going to get ripped off. You know what? That's the way the world works. In the comic book business, which is this inverted, incestuous industry, that is not the way it works. DC and Marvel are the corruption that lives around Camelot. In Camelot, where real people are, artists are able to keep the rights to their characters, and they get paid for doing the work. And they still keep the rights. There's people, those people." He said, "No, wait a second, Neil. No, that can't be. So these people can't pay me enough money to have me do it." I said, "Jack, hold on a second. You don't realize. You have no idea. I've talked to these people. This is Pacific Comics. And it's not Pacific Comics. It's a couple of guys, you know, and they have some money because they do comic book distribution." I said, "Jack, one of the things you don't want to tell these guys is how much DC and Marvel pay you. Because they think that you get paid like $300, $400 a page. And if you go in to them and you say, I'll take $120 a page, they'll be shocked. But if you tell them, Jack, that you get paid only $60 a page from DC and Marvel, they'll fall on their asses. Because they won't believe it. They won't believe that the wonderful Jack King Kirby is paid $60 a page. But you and I, Jack, you know, we know that you get paid $60 a page. They will be stunned, stunned, if you told them that. And of course they'll let you keep your character. You will own your character, and you will be able to." He said, "Neil, that can't be." I said, "Jack, trust me. Trust me. Go right ahead and do it." And, of course, he did. He did Captain Victory for Pacific Comics. A week later, I got the same phone call from Sergio Aragonés, who couldn't believe they let him keep his character. I said, "Sergio, you have a character. They're going to pay you for your work, and you're going to keep your character, not a percentage, 100%. 100%. Are you kidding me? Are you sure?" "Yes, I promise you." And that was the beginning of Gru the Barbarian, which has then, since then, jumped from company to company till now. And there's, you know, conversations about turning it into a movie. That is the beginning of the insanity, or pulling out of the insanity. It took me telling two of the greatest creators in the comic book business, "No, you have my permission to go ahead and do this, because what they're telling you is true." Somebody had to tell them that it was possible. Sometimes that's all it takes.
That was the first part of my conversation with legendary comic book artist and writer Neil Adams. There's more next week. After this, a little tease of what's coming your way in part two. Also, you can now find the show on iTunes. Just log on and search for BFM Heroes. Subscribe, leave us a review, it really helps. When we last left our heroes, the evening edition, BFM 89.9. In part two of my conversation with Neil Adams, we talk Batman and the Green Lantern, we talk Superman and Muhammad Ali, we talk superhero movies, and we talk about Neil Adams' deal with the devil.
And I'll tell you a secret, okay? Everybody says, you know, that, oh, Neil's a hero, and Neil does all this stuff, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. I'll tell you a story, and you can tell this to your audience, or you let me do it, okay? It's never what you think it is, okay? I'll tell you what the real truth is. You're going to get the real truth, okay? You ready?
All of that next Tuesday, same superhero time, same superhero channel. When we last left our heroes, the evening edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.